This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Colorado tomorrow, legal proceedings begin in a case that touches on American obsessions about money, sex, race, power, sports, and celebrity. The Kobe Bryant case is almost certain to be the next trial of the century, and many fear the next media circus. The defendant is one of the most famous men on the planet, a basketball superstar who's won 3 NBA championships with the Los Angeles Lakers and may be even better known from his television commercials. In a tearful news conference with his celebrity wife, Bryant admitted to the sin of adultery, but said that the sex was consensual. His accuser? Well, officially, all we know of his accuser is that she's 19 years old, worked at the resort hotel where Bryant stayed, and alleges that he forced her to have sex in his room. By this time, though, anyone who's followed the story knows, or thinks they know, a great deal about her emotional and sexual history. The media have published enough details about her life to make her identity obvious to her neighbors and friends, and anybody who wants to can easily find her name on the World Wide Web. Throw one more factor into the mix. There will be television cameras in the courtroom for tomorrow's preliminary hearing, and there's every indication that the trial will be televised as well. So before it begins, we want to focus on how the media covers celebrity trials and cases that involve allegations of rape in particular. Is it time to reconsider the rape shield laws that were designed to protect the identity of accusers? Are rape shield laws effective or relevant in an age of internet chat rooms and shock radio? When does an issue of public interest cross the line into voyeurism? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us to help sort out this high-profile and complicated case is Kelly McBride. She teaches ethics to journalists at the Poynter Institute and joins us now from their campus in St. Petersburg, Florida. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
A column you wrote says the Kobe Bryant case brings out the worst in American journalism. Explain, if you would.
Well, we have standards about how we cover rape cases that are almost universal in mainstream media outlets, and those standards seem not to apply when it involves a celebrity case.
Why is that?
I think because of the intense competition, because of the internet, like you said, and because we act without thinking a lot of times.
One of the first questions people will ask is, you know, why is the media giving so much attention to a charge of sexual assault? There are thousands of cases, regrettably, like this around the country. Why this particular one? Okay, he's a famous basketball player. So what?
Yet literally, there are hundreds of thousands of cases like this around the country. I think the celebrity is just an undeniable force in this case. Whenever you have celebrity involved in anything sexual, it becomes greater than the sum of its parts.
And one of the things that you mentioned in your column is when there is a case where a black man is accused of raping a black woman, which is essentially the charge in this case, that has history behind it.
Actually, when a black man is charged with raping a white woman, that has history behind it. And that is undeniable in this country, that as a society we have focused on that to the exclusion almost of other types of cases of rape and sexual assault, disproportionately, to be sure.
Tell us, there are some do's and don'ts that you put out in your column advising journalists what to do and what not to do in this case. What are some of the things that you advise them not to do?
Well, I guess most of that centers around the accuser, and I think we have a pretty well accepted standard that says we don't identify accusers because of the enormous amount of stigma and shame that accompanies the crime of rape. It is greater than the stigma and shame that accompanies any other type of crime in this country, and rape victims will verify that. So I think to identify her, or as you said, give us everything that we need to know to identify her, is the first thing. But I also think focusing on issues of her past relationships or her mental health or her social aspirations, without explicitly stating what relevance those have to the case, it is leaving it up to the readers or the viewers to imply that those facts are relevant, when in fact researchers will tell you that often they aren't relevant.
There is also a situation which is, if this goes to trial, and there's every indication that it is going to go to trial, this is going to involve a he said, she said exchange of allegations surrounding very intimate sexual acts. There's an undeniable element of voyeurism that we're all going to get into here.
Right, and it turns into very prurient type of journalism, if not carefully monitored. I think that the coverage can be measured and reasoned, and still give the readers and viewers what they need to know, give them the information they need, without crossing into voyeuristic or prurient type coverage.
There is another kind of coverage that you write about in your column, and that is those of perhaps the more mainstream media who say, boy, there is, you know, you can't believe the numbers of allegations out there. And let me just give you a few of these details that these outrageous people are talking about. Thereby reporting on the controversy over the allegations, you get to put in all the saucy details yourself.
Right. That's become quite a trend in the American media. We have media critics who cover television and newspapers just as they would cover other entities. I think that's a good thing to provide criticism or analysis of media coverage. But I think it can become an excuse to merely repeat the allegations. That's kind of, oh, what have we come to, and look what they're saying now, and then to provide this litany of horrible things that have been said about this person, and not really give reasons for repeating those. I think that if your goal is to truly provide valid criticism of the media, you can do that without repeating the harm that's already been done.
And a lot of the world has changed even since the William Kennedy Smith trial. That was 10 years ago. Yes, that was a televised trial too. We all remember the blue dot over the accuser's face. But one of the things that has truly changed is the dominance, or not dominance, but influence of internet outlets, some of which don't hesitate at all and seem to have no standards whatsoever.
Well, and that's true. There are people out there, anybody can put up a website, and there are people out there dealing in information who have no standards. I think that's all the more reason for professional journalists to state what their standards are and then adhere to them, so that we can separate ourselves from the shock jocks on talk radio and from tabloid journalists and from Joe Blow on the internet who's doing whatever he feels like doing.
And one other factor I wanted to put into this, and that is that a fair amount of the coverage that we're going to be getting of this case will be coming not just from news reporters, but from people assigned who usually work for the sports desk, because that's where a lot of the interest lies.
Right, but I actually have a lot of faith in sports reporters. I think that there have been different standards in the past in journalism for sports journalism versus news coverage. Increasingly, all of the major issues of society, whether it's racism or sexism or money or poverty, play themselves out on the sports pages. And I think sports reporters are a pretty savvy lot and just as capable of providing the type of reasoned, intelligent coverage that news reporters are capable of.
One of the issues we're focusing on is the relevance and usefulness of the rape shield laws. Joining us now from his office is David Shaw. He writes a weekly column on the media for the Los Angeles Times, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil. Thank you for having me.
You wrote a column last week titled, If the Accused is Named, the Accuser Should Be Too. Why do you believe that?
Well, I used to feel differently, but the more I've thought about the issue, the more it has seemed to me that two of the main guarantees of our criminal justice system are innocent until proven guilty and the right of the accused to confront his or her accuser. And while we do abide by those guarantees in the court of law, we don't do so in the court of public opinion, where the wounds can be even more enduring and painful.
So it's unfair to the defendant.
Yes, it seems to me that that's the case.
What was it that made you rethink this?
Well, there was no specific incident. I've written about it before and was generally on the other side of the argument, but I suppose to some extent the Internet contributed to that in the sense that anybody who wants to know her name now can find out. It's out on a number of websites. It's in tabloids. It's in various other locations. And it seems to me that the mainstream media, to some extent, is playing a charade and perpetuating a kind of pretense.
In other words, there once was a time when the New York Times and the Denver Post and the Los Angeles Times were the true gatekeepers of what the public got to know about these cases.
That's correct. Yeah, right, Neil. And now there are no gatekeepers. And it also, you know, it does seem to me that it's, I think we all agree that a woman's sexual history is irrelevant. I think we all agree that it is wrong to say that a woman somehow asked for it and that she shares some blame. And those are the factors that help contribute to the stigma attached to being a rape victim. But it seems to me the only way to get rid of that stigma is to take some of that shame away by printing her name the same way we do with any other crime. There is no other crime where we withhold the name of the accused, and the only time we withhold other names is when it's a minor. And I certainly think that we should continue to withhold names where minors are involved.
Again, the reason these rape shield laws came about was, at least in part, because of the stigma attached to the, to a woman who has been raped. It is extremely embarrassing. She may not want to tell everybody. This is designed to encourage such women to come out with less fear that they're going to be exposed. In a celebrity case like this, is there any prospect that any woman coming forward would not be exposed and have her whole previous past history raked over the newspapers?
I don't think there's any likelihood of that happening. And while I agree that celebrity cases don't necessarily make good law or good journalistic or public policy, the fact is you have to deal with the reality as it's presented to you. And, you know, the major stigma or embarrassment for this woman is in her own town. Well, everybody in her own town knows who she is. I mean, they've been talking to the reporters endlessly. People who are supposed to be her friends have been telling the reporters about suicide attempts and taking pills and various other issues. So just who are we protecting her from in terms of the stigma?
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's talk to Marn, who's on the line in Charleston, South Carolina.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment, particularly with your male guest right now, that rape is a different crime. When you're mugged, nobody debates the fact that you were mugged. When you're murdered, nobody debates that. Rape is the only crime where they look at the victim and say, prove that a crime actually occurred.
David Shaw?
Well, I'm sorry to say that's not true. You're innocent until proven guilty, and the burden of proof is always on the prosecution. In any case, it's up to the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime took place. Somebody may be dead. That doesn't mean they were murdered. That's why we have these cases.
I don't remember the last time I heard of a mugging victim or anyone else having their psychological history brought forward, having the criminal say, oh, but they meant to give me this money. I didn't actually take it from them.
Well, there are certainly plenty of crimes, white-collar crimes, where that's an issue all the time about whether it was intent.
Well, you don't have the victims' names all over the media, and you don't have
them
blamed potentially for the crime, which is what is going on in this case. This girl has already been convicted as being unstable by various commentators, so no crime could ever occur upon her.
Well, I don't think that, as I said in the beginning, that the news media ought to be talking about her sexual history or any of those other issues, and our paper has not. But I do think that if the accusations are made, and, you know, Kobe Bryant for the next several months has to stand out there accused of being a rapist, and let's face it, as bad as the stigma is that attaches to being a rape victim, I don't think anybody can deny that the stigma is even worse to be accused of being a rapist.
Marn, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And David Shaw, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
David Shaw is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. We spoke to him from his office in Los Angeles. When we come back from a break, Alan Goodman will be among our guests as we continue to discuss the Kobe Bryant case. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what kind of job the media are doing in covering the Kobe Bryant story. He has been ordered to appear for a preliminary hearing in Colorado tomorrow. That's going to be televised. Likely his trial will be televised as well. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Kelly McBride, an ethics faculty member at the Poynter Institute. She's with us from St. Petersburg, Florida. And joining us now from Maine is Ellen Goodman, a syndicated columnist for the Boston Globe. And thanks very much for taking a break from your vacation to talk with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Last week, you wrote an article called Rethinking the Rape Shield Law, in which you ask whether the time has come for the media to name names, and came to the conclusion that it has not.
That's right.
Why?
I think everybody's aware that there is no gatekeeper, that I was two clicks of the mouse away from finding out who she was, et cetera. But what David said is what I wrote, too, which is that celebrity cases really do make lousy journalism policy. And I give Kelly my condolences for trying to parse this one. But I'm concerned that if you take this, you change the policy and you start naming names, where do you stop? David just gently said, oh, of course we wouldn't name the names of children. Well, what if they appear on the Internet? What about the name of a teenager? Not that many rape victims are of such intense curiosity that they get their face out on the Internet. And rape is still a vastly underreported crime. I do think there's a real issue of, you know, naming the accused and not the accuser. I'm pretty sensitive to that. But I also think that we do not live in a post-shame society, that we are in a transitional time, and that we still need enough women to be willing to accuse. And that we have decided 30 years ago to protect her identity, and I don't think we're through that time yet.
Kelly McBride, just a factual question. Has the number of allegations of rape gone up since the Shield laws were enacted, as Ellen Goodman was saying, 30 years ago?
Well, it has, but it still doesn't nearly mirror what the incidence of rape is. And researchers compare the number of reports made to law enforcement to other research done by victimization studies where they try and detect unreported crime. And still, researchers are pretty confident that less than 25% of all rapes are reported to law enforcement.
That would seem, Ellen Goodman, to buttress your point that there's women who are still afraid to come out and identify their attackers.
Sure. And I don't know the truth about this case, and presumably, hopefully, it will come out in court. But the case against the accuser is very much of what they used to call the nuts and sluts, accusation. She's been accused literally of both of those parts of the old sexist, horrible lines.
Well, interestingly, one of the people who's been discussing this issue is Susan Estrich, who, as you know, is herself a victim of rape and has written a book about it. But she says it's particularly in celebrity cases, it may be time to name names, and that in this case, she thinks that the accuser will have no choice but eventually to come out and make her own case on television herself. Quote,
I think that's true, and I would do two things. I would certainly ask any victim of rape or any accuser if she wanted her name out. I don't think we have to assume protection of her, and I think there will be a certain portion, we've seen it already, there will be a certain portion of women who do feel that there's nothing to be ashamed of, who do feel that there's nothing worse than being mugged. And I think that that option should certainly be given to them. When you get to the line where you're talking about, okay, let's only out the accusers of celebrities. Well, who makes those decisions? A celebrity in your small town? A teacher in your small town? Is it does it have to rise to the level of a Kobe Bryant before we determine that it's a celebrity? I mean, that I would leave that in Kelly's hand, but could you imagine a group of journalists trying to decide, well, let's see, is this one a celebrity enough that we out the name?
Well, which group of journalists, too? I mean, National Public Radio or the Boston Globe can, you know, be accused of, you know, sitting high above this and saying, well, we wouldn't sully our hands with such things. You have to go to the web to find out that sort of thing, and we're just pretending that these details are not being reported and that her name isn't known.
That's true. On the other hand, do you follow the lowest common denominator? Do you say because she can find out on the web, you know, because all the kids are doing it, can we do it, Mom? You know, is that the right way to make decisions?
Email from James Reimer. There's another issue besides the right to right to privacy versus the right to know, that of the right to a fair trial, which arguably takes precedence over the other two. By protecting the identity of the accuser but not the accused, Judge Gannett is being prejudicial. It suggests the accuser is more credible than the accused. In the interest of a fair trial, it would have been better if neither name had been released, but once one name was made public, the other one should be too.
Well, I would be interested to know whether there was any... He's suggesting that it's prejudiced against the accused, and I don't think that there... I mean, think about the Kennedy case of some years ago. You know, he was found innocent under the same strictures that you're talking about, an enormous celebrity case in which her identity was protected until she, as Susan Estrich said, outed herself, but he was acquitted.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Ellen.
My pleasure.
And have a great vacation.
Okay.
Ellen Goodman is a syndicated columnist for the Boston Globe, and we reached her in an undisclosed vacation in the great state of Maine, where she's on vacation. Kelly McBride is still with us, an ethics faculty member at the Poynter Institute, where she teaches journalists some version of ethics, which she hopes they take away with them. And I think her success rate is awfully good. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Let's take a call from Kim, who's with us from Newport News, Virginia.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling to agree with your guests that celebrity cases don't tend to make good law. I'm a former prosecutor, and I think that rape cases are different, and I think that the rape shield laws are important because I think there would be a huge chilling effect on victims to stop them from coming forward. I've been in trials before where we've had to strike people from jury veneers for admitting, thank goodness they did admit, that they had biases against women who dressed provocatively or who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and thought that, you know, women can ask still to get raped. And I think that's very real, and it definitely exists today.
And what about the media's responsibility, though, for saying, here's where she goes to school, and here's every detail about her life, so if you want to know who she is, you'd have to be a dummy not to figure it out.
Right. I don't think that should be done. And I think, again, the celebrity cases are different. I don't think that's done in 99% of the cases, thank goodness, but I don't think it should be done.
Well, Kelly McBride, it's very difficult to restrain the media, isn't it?
Well, it's near impossible, although I think it's interesting that we keep saying rape shield laws. There actually are very few laws on the books that prevent journalists from publishing the names of rape victims. This is a voluntary censure that journalists have put upon themselves, and I think the fact that it's voluntary and that it's almost entirely universal among mainstream newsrooms speaks to the power of the argument still.
Kim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's try now to go to Alice, who's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hi.
Hi, Alice.
I just have a question, a couple questions related to the importance of sports and all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his status, Kobe's status as a sports celebrity, it seems to me would affect public sentiment and media coverage. One, I wonder if the gender split between men and women and how they feel about it is affected more here than perhaps with other kinds of celebrities. And I wonder, too, about, you know, it seems to me that the importance of sports in this country is so great that it's not an all exaggeration to think that there are a lot of people out there who are just resenting this woman for ruining the Lakers' chances at winning a championship, and that would actually trump, you know, the commission of a crime or the possible victimization of this woman. Well, I'm just wondering about those questions.
Well, Kelly McBride, as she brings up a good point, there have been issues of death threats in such cases.
Against the woman, right.
Yes.
And that is, I mean, that is I mean, one consideration, and oftentimes on a local level when journalists are covering crime, if a victim or a witness's life is in danger, where they will protect that person's identity. So there is a precedent on that level. But I think what the caller is talking about is this general importance or gravity that sports have taken on in our society, and I think that is just an area ripe for exploration by journalists that I haven't seen done very well in light of this case. Is why is this so important, and is it true that some people think that the Lakers' chances at a championship are more important than justice or even fairness in this case? Hmm. I would love to see more journalism on that.
Alice, appreciate the phone call.
Thanks a lot.
As we've been hearing, the Kobe Bryant case presents journalists with a number of ethical dilemmas. It's often the editor who has to sort those through. Joining us now to talk about how decisions on this story are being made at his newspaper is Leo Walensky, Deputy Managing Editor at the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
How is this story being handled at the LA Times? Is it being treated as a sports story or a crime story, or given Kobe's prominence, a business story?
Well, it's a little bit of all those things, and it's being handled very carefully. Right from the beginning, we had meetings on how we were going to handle this. We are handling it different than other more routine stories. And we actually are covering it with a combination of sports and national reporters at the moment. But our Metro reporters have been involved, our legal affairs people, our business people, everybody has had a piece of the story at one point or another.
And the managing editor's job is, you're the deputy managing editor, but for one thing, the business editor, the sports editor, and the news editor, they all talk to you.
They do. Myself and two or three others, top editors here at the paper, and every day we look at the stories that are coming in, and we try to make sure that we're not putting something in there that we'll regret later. The stories, of course, are vetted in the usual way. They're written by the reporter. They're seen by their line editor. They go up to the department head, and they eventually make their way to our desks. We had a principle here that we started, which was to have our reporters report very aggressively, but we've decided at the same time that we're going to publish conservatively. So there's a bit of a tension in the system.
It sounds like you're being defensive about it.
Defensive? I don't know if it's defensive. I think what we're trying to do is uphold the standards that we believe are important. We know that they're not being upheld elsewhere. We know that every day we're going to get up in the morning and probably see certain things that we already know about published elsewhere, maybe in another newspaper, maybe on television, maybe in a tabloid. And so the normal rules of competition don't necessarily apply in a case like this, so we have to be more careful than normal.
Well, I want to follow up on both sides of that. You said earlier, obviously you want to be careful not to make a mistake. You don't want to make a mistake on any story, but
right.
On a story this big, you really want to be careful not to make a mistake.
Because it's not just an issue of being factually accurate, because I believe our reporters are factually accurate. It's how much information do you want to give? When you find out certain facts about this case, again, the question is, are these facts relevant? Are they simply something that will go to the credibility of one side or the other, or are they something that simply would dirty somebody up and not be relevant to the case in the end? We know in a case like this that both sides are going to be spinning like crazy and that there are going to be all kinds of rumors put out on the street. And it's our duty to really sift through this and try to give the facts as they are and not to fall into that dilemma. It reminds me in many ways of the O.J. Simpson case, which we were right in the middle of here, too.
Sure.
And in that case, we followed this principle, which was that we would not put anything in the paper that we did not verify ourselves. In other words, the National Enquirer or the New York Times or the Boston Globe had published a piece of information about the story, and we could not verify it, we wouldn't simply put it in our news columns as reported by the Boston Globe or as reported by the National Enquirer. We wouldn't use it at all unless we could verify it ourselves.
We're speaking with Leo Walensky, who's the deputy managing editor at the Los Angeles Times, about his preparations to cover the Kobe Bryant case. A preliminary hearing is scheduled in Colorado tomorrow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You mentioned one other aspect that I wanted to follow up on, and that is competition. There's another daily newspaper there in Los Angeles. Obviously, you've got a whole bunch of television stations and radio stations, not to mention all these internet sites that we've been talking about, all covering the same story. How big a deal is this? If your readers start to feel that the Times is getting beat on this story, are they going to migrate somewhere else?
Well, it's always a concern. It's always a question. It is very competitive, and we have several other daily newspapers operating out here, and several of them have reported things about this case that we have not. These are things that we've known about, but we have not reported because we decided it wasn't relevant to the case. But for us, even though, you know, someone might look and think that we're not aggressive enough on this story, we feel it's a slippery slope. Once you start into one thing, you say, well, the name is on the internet. This particular incident is in the paper, and we start putting it in there. Then you're letting someone else do your news judgment for you. You're not exercising your own independent news judgment. We're striving very, very hard to make sure that we're maintaining that standard ourselves.
How do you balance the news coverage and the sports coverage? I think you've got mail. Anyway, how do you balance those two things? I mean, you can end up on a very sensitive day in this story. Sensational charge or allegation is made in court. And at the same time, one of your sports columnists says, you know, Lakers chances appear blown now.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things can really look awkward next to each other or even in the same newspaper.
They can. Of course, you know, your columnists, have wide latitude to write about what they feel they should write about, so long as, again, they don't violate the standards that we're setting. We're not letting our columnists put things in their columns that we wouldn't put in the news columns either if it turns to be something factual about the case. So we're trying to maintain that balance throughout, and it's up to the department heads, in this case the sports editor, to maintain that.
What's been the most difficult decision you've had to make so far?
I think it's been to not to report some of the things that we found out, some of the things that other publications have reported, and it's difficult because your reporters are out there working very hard. They come up with information that's solid. They write a story, you look at it and say, nope, we're not going to use it, even though we know it's factual, even though we know it's accurate, but we decide that it violates our standards, and then to pick up somebody else's paper the next day or to watch it on television and see somebody else have an exclusive on this.
And other people then reporting on that person's exclusive.
Exactly, and it echoes all over the place, and we're not present in that. And we feel proud about that, but at the same time, it makes us sweat a little bit.
Gnashing of teeth, I think,
yeah,
is what we're hearing there. Leo Walensky, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Leo Walensky is deputy managing editor at the Los Angeles Times, and he spoke to us from his office there. We're going to take a short break now and continue this conversation with Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute and more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're also going to be talking with Peter Neufeld, the director of the Innocence Project at the Cardozo Law School, about a plan by prosecutors in New York State to charge DNA profiles, otherwise unknown criminals, with rape to get around the statute of limitations. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now we're going to wrap up our conversation on the media's handling of the Kobe Bryant sexual assault case with Kelly McBride, who teaches ethics to journalists at the Poynter Institute. And Kelly, wanted to bring listeners back into our conversation. Let's go back to Charlie, and Charlie joins us on the line from Denver.
Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to make a comment about the lack of responsibility of the Internet and and how that's really a pretty poor model for journalists to be following. Here in Denver, we've been following a story where there's a young woman in the same town with the first same name who has nothing to do with the case, and yet she's had her picture plastered all over the Internet, basically saying this is the woman that has been raped, and it has been devastating to her. And I understand that journalists, they actually can be held responsible for what they put on their paper or on the TV. And but here on the Internet, this is... these people are anonymous, and I just wanted to get your response to that.
Well, Kelly McBride, some of those people consider themselves journalists, too.
Yeah, although I don't think most of them would make that claim with a straight face. I think they pretty much know that they're out there for the entertainment value or the shock value of what they're doing, and have very little understanding of the value of journalism in a democracy. It's interesting that you bring that up, because that's actually... used by many journalists who are in favor of more openness and rape coverage, and in fact naming victims, as saying at least we're responsible and we should take control of the information. Now, personally, I think that there are other things that we could do to take control of the information, and it could start with reporting on rape as a more serious issue in society rather than just the news event that we relegate it to. And we could take some other steps before we take that step of naming rape victims.
In terms of accountability, libel laws in this country are very, very difficult to prosecute.
They are. They're. You have to have some resources to do it. Second of all, depending on who you're suing for libel, I suspect that most of the people on the Internet don't have very deep pockets. Most of these people who are publishing these websites. So I don't know that it would be financially fruitful. They don't carry criminal penalties in terms of jail time, so all you get is the civil judgment. So I'm not sure that it would be worth the time of most people who have been harmed by somebody with a website on the Internet. Although it's possible, and I wouldn't doubt that will come up with something similar to these cases. You know, if it's not this case, it'll be another case. Trying to create some sense of accountability for the information that you put out there.
And I should add, just in terms of, fessing up for others in my own medium, radio has played no small part in this as well, Charlie.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Jane, and Jane's on the line in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Yes. I thought it interesting. Mrs. McBride had said something earlier. She had mentioned that this is definitely an inflammatory issue, particularly when it is a black man accused of such a crime involving a white woman. And I wanted to bring up a point of view that's not necessarily popular, but to sort of bring it to the public consciousness, and that is that I think that this may be potentially very inflammatory when it involves the race of these two individuals, because a lot of us really do sort of liken the allegations that have been levied against Kobe Bryant as allegations that we've really seen since the beginning of slavery times on forward, where white women have levied such accusations against black men. And I was wondering what Ms. McBride thought about that.
Well, I don't think you can ignore that. And I think as journalists, there are ways that we can talk about the history, the threat of black male sexuality that has been perceived by the white population. Those are all issues that we can talk about, and then ask the question, how is that playing out in this case, without necessarily creating a prejudicial situation where you're saying this did or did not happen, because that's up to a court to decide. So I just think that it brings a specific charge to this particular case that is being talked about. It's being talked about in chat rooms on the Internet, and it's being talked about in coffee shops.
That's
and
right.
And in gyms and on basketball courts and in barbershops and in hair salons all over the country. And I think that we as responsible journalists could give name in a responsible way to the phenomenon without necessarily creating a bias and saying it did or didn't happen.
That's right.
Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Kelly, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Kelly McBride teaches at the Poynter Institute, and she spoke to us from her office there in St. Petersburg, Florida. Last night, during a nationally broadcast interview on Access Hollywood, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks basketball team, Mark Cuban, said that from a business perspective, the Kobe Bryant story is, quote, great for the NBA. Mark Cuban joins us now from his office in Dallas, and thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Neil.
Great for the NBA?
Well, first, you're putting in an emphasis that I did not put on. I'm not talking from the perspective that, hey, this is a promotional opportunity, let's take advantage of it. The context of the conversation was, this is an unfortunate reality and then a commentary on how we use media in society. The fact that there's so much notoriety that's been built up by the media, the unfortunate side effect is that the NBA business will benefit, just like media has benefited from it. And the first game that Kobe plays in is going to be must-see TV. People are going to watch it to see how Kobe responds and what the frenzy is that is created around him. And whether we like it or not, that's what's going to happen. And for whatever reasons, you know, just like you took a quote probably without having heard it originally and made it sound like I was trying to trump it up like, hey, let's do this more often, that's not the case at all. It's an unfortunate scenario. It's a tragedy. But, you know, the reality in our world today is, you know, train wreck TV turns into reality TV, which turns into the highest possible ratings. And that'll turn into an economic benefit for media and the NBA included.
As you know, I mean, I think people to this morning that I was listening to were saying that certainly in the short term, you're right, that first game is going to get tremendous ratings, and
right,
there will be an awful lot of people tuning in to see what happens. In the longer term, though, not only this case, but there have been many celebrated cases of athletes been charged various kinds of crimes. This is not good for the image of the Basketball Association, is
it? I would tell you that most of us have short attention span theater memories. That, you know, you can look at, you know, forget the NBA, look at, you know, the Super Bowl champ, or Super Bowl MVP from several years ago was accused of murder and now is getting endorsements. You know, you can look at Allen Iverson, who 3 years ago was considered the quote-unquote criminal element and now has, you know, one of the three top-selling jerseys. You know, you can look at Colin Farrell. You can look at a variety of different people in entertainment who go through a variety of legal issues. I haven't heard anybody tell me they're not going to watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off because of the charges brought against whoever the truant officer was, I forget the guy's name.
Right.
You know, we don't do a rap sheet history on people before we make our entertainment choices, even though those are fun things to propose and discuss.
So, in a sense, what you're saying is, gee, there is no such thing as bad publicity. If you're getting the pub, it's great.
No, what I'm saying isn't so much. It's not that at all. What I'm saying is, our society as it is today, we use media to create notoriety, and we've fallen prey to that. We allow the media to build up anybody that they choose to be the focal point of the moment, and we chase that person around wherever they may go. You know, yes, the NBA will benefit from this. Short-term, definitely. Long-term, who knows? I mean, there's always a possibility for a negative impact. Long-term, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But NPR and other media benefits from it as well. There's nobody out there in the media saying, you know, we should not talk about this. We should hinder the discussions. We should shut it down so that it's not an issue and there's no economic impact. It's the exact opposite. Everybody is trumpeting it. Everybody is taking advantage of it. Everybody is playing it up to the heat, to the hilt, to their own economic advantage. It just so happens that I just came out and stated the obvious and stated the facts.
Well, Mark Cuban, we appreciate your willingness to come on and talk about it with us.
I appreciate it, Neil, anytime.
Mark Cuban is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks team in the National Basketball Association. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.